I'm Tom Madden, once again at the home of Jack Evans in the Grand. Today we'd like to talk a little bit about immigrant trails in Union County. And Jack, did you want to start with the talk, just summarize briefly the trip of the Whitmans and the route they would have taken when they came in? Wasn't that in 1836?
Mm-hmm.
Right around in there?
38. The Whitmans and later, a little later, Jason Lee went that way. Lee was with Wyeth's party, I believe, and the Whitmans were more or less just their own party. But there were others who went the same way. The early missionaries followed that route. And they came into the Grand Ronde in the same way that the Oregon Trail did, down Ladd Hill and across the valley. And from the Grand Ronde River, they turned northwest and went up Fox Hill. And I am not sure exactly where that first road went. It was the same as the 1843 route of the wagon trains. Later, they went across the valley up Beach Avenue, actually, and behind Table Mountain, over the ridge, and across the plateau to drop down to the Grand River where Hilgard Park is now. But the first ones went up Fox Hill, and I don't believe they could have gone the way the present road does, because there's a bald knob up there that would have been too steep, I think, for the wagons to get up, especially considering the kind of footing that would tear the hooves of the oxen. That's all what they called, the name escapes me at the moment, but it's broken rock, cut rock they called it, all sharp corners, and it will eat tires on the car. So they probably went up the wooded canyon that is just east of Fox Hill a little bit. I think they could have gotten up that without too much difficulty. And I do know from one or two of the things they wrote, and they weren't too good diarists in 1843, but they did mention sending parties of young fellows on ahead to cut brush and clear the trail. So there were areas where they did have to cut their way through the timber. But when the Whitmans went through, of course, this was just a horse trail. And they had pack horses, but nobody used wagons at that time. And they went up Fox Hill, and from the summit up there, there is a very nice, gentle swale that goes right down to Five Points Creek. And the Whitman Trail went that way, and so did the 1843 wagon train from Five Points. It's a spot, a meadow there on the bottom called Camp 1, which dates from one of the early mills, sawmills in the area. On the north side of that, there's one place on the hillside, the bank, or the side of the canyon, that is negotiable. It isn't steep as the rest of them, and they went up that way, and when they reached the top, there's a flat up there, and they would have gone straight out to the end of the point where Sacagawea Spring is, and then down into the bottom of Meacham Creek Canyon, up the side, and on down Horseshoe Ridge. That was where the horse trail, the old Indian trail, went. And the 1843 train took it as far as the Big Flat, and then they turned west and went over to where the present Mount Emily Road interchange is, and on north. That's the route that the well-known part of the Oregon Trail took. So they went that way.
Was the 1843 train the first big year on the trail for wagons, for emigrant wagons?
Yeah, it was the first one where some of them actually took their wagons all the way through. Many of them left them at the Whitman Mission and took rafts down the river or whatever in 1843. And one of them, who was very sure of himself, as he said, he stove up at Utility Falls and lost everything they had. But rafting wasn't such a good idea, but many of them did that. The 1840, I believe it was, when the mountain men, Joe Meek and some others, realizing the last rendezvous had been held and the fur trade was about done, decided they would try their luck at something else in Oregon. And they, being mountain men, they knew the country and took their own time about it, but they picked up some abandoned wagons at Fort Hall, and took them about 3 months to make their trip, but they took the wagons all the way to the Whitman Mission. So it was known by that time then that you could take a wagon across the Blue Mountains, and the 1843 train did. It was guided, partly at least, by Marcus Whitman.
Yeah, and that train would have gone, again, up the Fox Hill route.
Yes, it did.
Did trains ever go, or travelers go north to where Elgin is? In other words, come in Ladd Hill, go north across the valley over Pumpkin Ridge, and then go west over the present Tollgate Road. Was that any kind of a wagon road up there?
Well, it was later. I don't know. It originally was another Indian trail. And that was the route that Fremont took in 1843 when he came through here.
Oh, okay.
He was guided by Kit Carson, and who knew all of the West reasonably well, and Carson took him across that way. They did have a wagon that had surveying instruments and scientific instruments in it. They had a cannon with them and a limber, which had to be dragged behind. So they needed more than just a trail that was one horse wide, but the that route, part of it, you can easily see, not exactly ruts, but you can see where it was from about where Reinhardt is. Willow Creek goes under Highway 82 at that point, and there's a meadow there, a good-sized meadow with oxbows of this very slow-moving stream in it, and Fremont refers to the stream as being quite deep, and people, I think there were a couple hundred of them, they camped on that meadow, and then they went right on about where the present Highway 82 does till you get to the top of the ridge, and where it bends to the right to go across the summit and down to the river, that turned off. There's a dirt road there that turns off at the same point they did, and it goes over a nice low spot in that ridge and right down to the Grand Ronde. Hits it about a mile west, I think, of where the present bridge is. And from there they went on across the flat to the timber. There was a nice stand of pine timber where Elgin is today. Fremont estimated some of the trees as being 6.5 feet through and 200 feet tall, and I'm sure he was correct. He had a pretty good eye for such things. But from there, they went up Gordon Creek.
Okay.
And I don't know the exact route of it, although at least one person does know where the old ruts are, and it came out on the present Tollgate Highway at about Tollgate, or just this side of it, I understand. And then from there they went across and down Lincoln Mountain, and there's a pretty bad road that goes down that way yet. I don't know if other travelers over it, although it was well known, and the Indians had used it, and somewhere, I am sure it was 1856, and this was a kind of bad year for Indian problems, but I read this someplace, and I wish I could remember where I saw it. Anyway, it mentioned a single woman who was, this was an unusual thing in those days for a woman to travel alone, and she had a spring wagon, and she hired an Indian to take her across that route in her wagon. And I have no idea where I saw that. It's been 30 years since I read it, but it's always stuck in my mind that there was always a way known across that part.
And that, again, would have been up Gordon Creek or following the route of the Fremont.
Same trail.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
But the Fremont's cannon wasn't an enormous thing. It was a mountain howitzer which had a brass barrel about 2 feet long and fired a shot weighing 12 pounds. And since it was the model 1841, and this was only 2 years after it was adopted, I think, when Senator Benton sent his son-in-law out here to look things over, this was taken along either to impress the Indians or maybe to see what practical use it might have in mountain country. It's a type that was used very little in the Civil War, except in the Western campaigns that we used it a little bit. But it was something of a hindrance, but they course took it along until they ran into snow in the Sierras, and at that point they had to abandon the cannon. So there have been stories ever since about where the cannon went and whether anybody ever found it or not.
That's an interesting speculation, isn't it? That it's sitting up there in the Sierras someplace.
Yeah,
still,
might
maybe.
Be.
Mm-hmm. Who knows?
Who knows?
It would have been towed by, what, a couple of horses? Or
yeah, there would have a limber to go with it, which is a cart, with it's an ammunition cart, really. And then there would have been a team that would have pulled the pulled the cannon. It was lightweight for its day. I think the barrel weighed 200 pounds. And it was designed to be taken apart and all the parts carried on horseback, so it didn't have to be dragged. But it was just as easy to pull it on its wheels, probably, as it would have been to carry it on pack horses or mules.
And then you had to carry the ammunition some way anyway.
Yeah, the limber had the ammunition in it. Sometimes those limbers had 12 or 15 rounds of either shells or solid cannonballs, plus a number of musket cartridges. But I think what Fremont would have taken along probably would have been mostly cannonballs. Mm-hmm. And he did fire it, I think, a few times to impress the Indians, and I believe they were suitably impressed.
I can
just like
imagine.
Kids at fireworks, you know.
So that expedition was guided by Kit Carson.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was well-known frontiersman, and would probably have been a natural for a military expedition, which essentially was what Fremont's was. He didn't perform as a soldier necessarily, although it was a military reconnaissance, really. Mm-hmm. And the idea was to get a better idea of the country and how the tribes were organized and other things that might be necessary in case they had to campaign in the West, I think. Benjamin Bonneville, when he came out here in 1834, he was on an extended military reconnaissance too, kind of the same idea. But he got so wrapped up in the romantic notions of life as a mountain man that he overstayed his leave and had a heck of a good time. And when he went back, he was temporarily suspended while he wrote down the account of his travels and turned that over to Washington Irving, who made a pretty good book out of it.
Right. That wasn't, let's see, Francis Parkman, that was a different book.
Parkman, he wrote the book called The Oregon Trail.
Right.
But it only goes as far as western Nebraska, I think.
Yeah, because that's as far as he went,
I guess.
That's
as far as he went, yeah. Mm-hmm. It gives you an idea of what it was like to start out, but mm-hmm. nothing beyond that point.
Nothing over this way. Did Bonneville come through the Grand Ronde Valley?
Yeah, he was here. When he came in, as Hunt had done, he tried to go down the Snake River through Hell's Canyon, and that didn't work out very well. Hunt had to turn back and had quite a tough time. But Bonneville, they found a ridge that came down pretty much to the river, and they went up that. And this was at a bad time of year. Hunt had come through in the middle of the winter, too. But Bonneville got up to the top of the ridge and crossed over and went down into the Imnaha Canyon. And from there, made his way. He was with the Nez Perce, who were living there in the winter, usually. And he didn't come through the Willow Valley, I don't think, though he may have. But he went generally in that direction. He explored around over Oregon, was up to the Blue Mountains part of the time, and he tried to get supplies from the Hudson's Bay Company, who wouldn't sell him anything. They didn't encourage competition. And he did have a vision of being a champion fur trader himself. So they offered to, if he wanted to come back with them, and they would take care of these people, travel with a fur brigade across the country. He could have done that, but he was a stubborn man. He said, no, he'd go back the way he came. So he crossed the Willows twice. It was a rather grim trip each way. So he must have known pretty much about the high country up there in the Willow Mountains. I'm not sure that he would have gone back up the Imnaha and across the ridge and down into halfway. About but, right in there.
But he didn't. Did he actually come through this valley?
He was in the Grand Ronde part mm-hmm. of the time, I believe, if I remember his narrative correctly. And I'd like to have seen his journal. I'd like to see Hunt's journal. I don't know what John Jacob Astor did with that one, and I have no idea what the Army did with the other one. But so all we have is his experience as Washington Irving interpreted it.
Mm-hmm.
And Irving hadn't been out here and didn't know the country, so he was lost as much as Bonneville was part of the time. There's nowadays it's easy to figure longitude because we have chronometers that keep perfect time. In Fremont's day, he had probably the best watch that was available, ordinarily available, but it was off. And so his observations, scientific observations, he always shot the sun and wrote the longitude down wherever they camped. But he was off. Some fellow who wrote the Oregon Historical Quarterly back around 1911 traced Fremont's route by his astronomical observations rather than referring to Charles Price's map. He was the cartographer that went with Fremont. His maps are good. But anyway, this man was going by Fremont's journal. And he had him crossing the Olao Valley, I think, in that area. 50 miles is what it was. What is the amount of error?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Fremont's chronometer was off by 50 miles in time. It would have equaled 50 miles in longitude. So it's a good thing that Price did his maps. Otherwise, we might be a little confused as to where Fremont was.
Where he actually went?
Yeah, his maps are good and. The one that shows where they crossed into the, well, across the Powder River over in Baker Valley, and then where they crossed the Grand Ronde Valley. And it shows, doesn't show much of a valley where Elgin is, but it does show the direction they took and how they got across the mountains and down and into Whitman's Mission. Fremont had wanted to visit the mission, and they did. But those maps are good.
Well, you know, another date, speaking of the Whitman Mission, that when the Whitman Mission was destroyed and closed, I think that was in 1847,
yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. That caused a shift in the route, correct? I mean, they didn't go...
Well, there were two things that caused it. That certainly was one. But Whitman was off the to one side of the... most direct route to the Willamette Valley.
Yeah, it was really a detour to go see Whitman,
yes,
right?
Yes, it was.
It was more of a detour.
The first wagon train went that way because he guided them, so they naturally went to his mission. Most of them were annoyed at what they thought of as being terribly overcharged for any supplies that he let them have. Of course, it cost him something to get the whatever he needed there and to raise it, and that was a factor, but they felt that they were being overcharged, some of them. And others realized that they had gone 40 miles out of their way with teams that were wearing out. So they, after that, they generally went the more direct route, and Whitman would meet them at some point, maybe Cayuse about, and sell them provisions. And in later years, the Cayuse became such good farmers that they were the ones that sold all the produce to the emigrants, and they had good stuff to sell them. Whitman, like so many missionaries, he didn't come to learn but to teach. And so he steadfastly refused to learn anything from the people he was teaching. And... in other words, he kind of sealed his own fate in a way. And when it did finally happen, it wasn't actually a massacre. It's always been called that, but I think 16 people died out of 105, something of that sort. One of the casualties was Joe Meek's daughter by his Nez Perce wife who had died, and he called her Helen Marr, which is an interesting name. That's the heroine in Jane Porter's book, The Scottish Chiefs, 1830. Anyway, it was a very popular novel, and most of the mountain men were avid readers. You wouldn't know it by the language they used, but they read a lot. James Clyman was one. You could tell by reading his diary, you could tell he's familiar with Byron. They read the classics, and they read a lot. So, anyway, that's just an aside about Joe Meek's little girl. But she died of neglect, apparently, not from being killed by anyone.
That was in 1847.
47.
And then, well, when did trails start going up here out of La Grande, the B Street route? I mean, wagon route.
Pretty early. It's either 1844 or 1845.
So before Whitman.
Yes.
Okay.
But they, it was either 44 or 45. One year, they talk about two routes, a detour. And one of them took one route, and the other one took the other, and they wound up over somewhere coming back together again. But the route, that even steep as it is, going from La Grande right up over the ridge, and they had to tackle it head on. They couldn't side hill without tipping the wagon over. So even there, they had some pretty steep going. But it was straighter, more direct.
Would they double team?
Oh, yeah.
Just come on. So anyway, we were just asking about double teaming. So basically, they did then. At the head of B there, they would double team and take one wagon up and then go back down and teams and take the next one up.
Yes, the lower part of that is steep, but not too terribly bad. They probably double teaming might have been enough to do it. And then when they got up to where it kind of levels off, there's a bench there. They crossed the bench and then went on up over the ridge point. It really is steep, and I remember two of them mentioning specifically, one said that it took, I think, 9 span of oxen to get their wagon up the slope, which is 18 animals, and I think the other one said 18 animals, so they took as many oxen as it took to get the wagon to the top, then they'd go back down and bring up another one. And it took quite a while to get up that hill, I think.
Well, would they have camped at the bottom here somewhere? Was there a campsite along B Street somewhere?
Yes, that whole bench area up there near Mill Creek was the old pioneer campground.
Okay, so I would see them, then they would in the morning try to start out and get up and over the hill, and then they'd get as far as Hillgard maybe that over about one day?
Usually they did a little better. They didn't like to stop where Hillgard Park is because it's near water, but there isn't much grass. And so there was nothing for the animals to eat, really. And they tried to get across the plateau and down to the river and up the other side. And when they got on across the ways, then they would camp. And one of those camps was the one where they had to go down to the bottom of California Gulch in the dark and get water and lug it back up to the top of the hill in buckets. So
that's kind of somewhere near that interpretive center is now, or the Blue Mountain Crossing Interpretive Center. It's in that general area?
Somewhere not too far from there. That's right up above California Gulch.
Yeah, right.
But they managed to get about that far. Some of them, at least, and of course they camped in other places. And along there's an area where the trail runs. You can't see it anymore, but as you from Hillgard Park go up the hill on the freeway, and near the top, it's just on your right, out on that kind of flat. And from there, it went down and across Pelican Creek, and up the north side. So they're off to the north of you while you're when you go farther towards Spring Creek.
Yes, I walked on that, coming from Five Points Creek, you know, walking up the road, just a geographical thing. When they came over Fox Hill and down to Five Points, then did they actually follow, that's Pelican Creek there, did they follow Pelican Creek then?
No,
I mean, this is before they took the other
route. This was the 1843 train. They just went right across the creek. It would be Five Points Creek. They went right across Five Points Creek. And
up past Hillgo, past the...
Cross Pelican Creek is just... it's just above Hillgard there. There's a railroad overpass right there, and there's a little hollow meadow. Later on, that was where they pastured horses for the stagecoaches, in that little place right in there.
Oh, you mean where the railroad goes across Pelican Creek now? There's a railroad bridge there, right? And then there's a Forest Service road that takes off up the hill along above the creek, going kind of northwest there. And you can actually get to where you can find the trail from there, because the trail comes down the hill from the other way.
Yeah, there's the north side of Pelican Creek. It's kind of rough in there, and I don't think people have yet figured out exactly where the wagons went, but as soon as you get up there on that flat, the ruts are clearly visible.
Oh, you mean on the north side of Pelican Creek?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, because...
On the south side of Pelican Creek and up toward the freeway, if you go up that kind of a little draw, there are traces of an old road in there, and that's the old highway. The route, it went up there and made a kind of a double S curve and then went on across the ridge where the present one goes. And in there, there are little fireplaces and things where it's a picnic area. And some people have thought this was trail associated. It's not. That's the old highway.
Right,
it's down in the timber right there.
Yeah, I've never people have told me that. I've never found that. I tried to find it when they was just was looking in the wrong place. But the trail
It's easy to locate, actually.
But the trail does actually, coming up from the present Hillgard Park, it does actually go up to the top of the hill and then northwest down to the creek.
Right.
You can follow that, too.
It can be followed. It's pretty faint across there, but the... one thing to remember at Hillgard Park, when they came down off of the mountain to the south and across the river, as one said, you go for 400 yards downstream and then go up and over the hill. And where the present Starkey overpass, it goes over the park and goes to the juvenile center up there, right at about the same place where that is, there was a point that came down to the river, and that point has been completely obliterated by highway and freeway construction. And on the north side, there's a cliff. And if you go up on the other side, you'll find at the top of the cliff that the old trail ruts go on to the north from the top of the cliff, because they went right up that point, and the point's gone.
So they came and crossed the... would they have crossed the stream already? They would have had to cross the river.
Yeah, they crossed the river. Usually they... I think they crossed it and came over to the north side of it. I think the bank was a little better there. And they came along the north side of
it. And then went up that point.
And then went up that point. Yeah. Turned it right up the point.
But did they also come over then to the south of that cliff near where you go into the Job Corps Center, you know, on your left as you're headed for the Job Corps Center... As you're headed south.
There are some old tracks up there. That's the Foster Toll Road, which is much later. It follows the timber line on the opposite side of the meadow to the east and goes on south. And then on up, I think, Whiskey Creek, or Rock Creek, one of those little canyons. But the main trail went up that point, and it's hard to believe that there was ever a point there now. And also it looks like the north side is pretty steep, but actually when you get up on top, the old trail is just right up through the huckleberry brush and whatnot, and are perfectly clear. They fade out again once you get further toward the top, and there's been an awful lot of excavation and filling, putting in the freeway, They have built up the bank on the east side quite a bit to keep it from sliding. And it's not until you get quite a bit further up that you can find any trail traces much.
Right. But they did go up Pelican Creek, and when they were coming the other way, they would come down near where the where Pelican Creek enters Five Points Creek, or rather, I should say, which is the stream that the railroad crosses? Is that Pelican or Five Points?
That's Pelican. Well, it crosses them both, I think. But Pelican Creek is the one that comes down from the west.
Yeah. Okay.
And Five
right,
Points
right.
Creek comes down from the east, from the direction of Mount Emily.
Right. Right.
And
gotcha.
They run together right
they
there.
They run together right there. Yeah.
They're right there at Hilgard. That's where
right.
they join.
They joined just below that railroad bridge.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah.
But the trail came down there then. It came down
into Pelican Creek just about where the railroad
bridge is.
And you leave Hilgard Park and go up the point and over the top, and at the top you're kind of right alongside the freeway.
Mm-hmm, right.
And then you drop down again into the Pelican Creek bottom, mm-hmm. and cross over about where the railroad bridge is, and then go up a big flat that's off to the north there.
Mm-hmm.
And
today we have been, kind of going back and forth about your own researches here, and you've written a book about the Oregon Trail in Union County, actually, or in Northeast Oregon, right? Called Powerful Rocky.
Mm-hmm.
You want to tell us just a little bit about that book and what it covers?
Well, the title is from the diary of a man named Absalom Hardin, who came through in 1847, and this is how he described the hill, Lad Hill, coming down into the valley from the south. And he said it's about 6 miles long from where you first start to descend it, and it's Powerful Rocky. And the rocks are about as big as a person's head up there, so I imagine he saw quite a few of them. I had always wanted to do a project like this, and I had the opportunity at about the time I retired to do it. And it required 3 years in the research and the writing, and probably about actually a year and a half or 2 years in research, third year in the writing. And it was lucky that I had the resources of the Regional Services Institute up there, because what I did in longhand and then redid on the typewriter, they could put in the word processor. And after that, they'd hand me a stack of print, and I would go through and revise and edit and correct and hand it back, and they'd input the corrections and I'd get it back. By the time the book was actually published, I'd saved all those copies, and I think the stack of paper was 5.5 feet high. So lots of going back and forth, and at the end we proofread it, a group of us together. So it's really a pretty clean copy. The maps in it are all from the USGS quadrangles on which the trail has been plotted by other people as well as myself. And it's checking out in the years since 1990 as pretty accurate. Nowadays, they're going along with the global positioning system indicators and checking against the map, and it seems to be right on in most places. And that's not surprising, because these are the same ruts that several other people before my time found, some of which are no longer visible. And I caught a few that are no longer visible myself, and have found one piece of it that we didn't know about. So this is just a kind of a lifetime thing, really. And when I did it, I tried to avoid reminiscences as much as possible, and stick pretty much to things written at the time. What you write down at the end of a day is probably more accurate than what you can tell about it 50 years later.
So you worked a lot with the journals that people
kept. Yes, I did. There were two or 300 of, I think about 300, and I think I quoted from maybe half that many, or maybe 200, I don't know. I haven't bothered to check that again. But I tried to get a pretty representative selection. Some of them were just people that would say, made 30 miles today and saw 40 graves, you know, this kind of thing, and how many dead cattle and so on. If it was a boring trip, well, that's what you keep track of. And for the fellows really excited, and some of the women who were along got excited by the scenery, although they had the drudgery, like the cooking and trying to keep things clean and keep people fed and so on. But the people are the most interesting thing, and nearly all of them are interesting in one way or another. A nice cross-section of the 19th century Americans. And there were some that, oh, they would betray a good sense of humor, and others, some were unhappy. The ones that were sick were the ones that were mostly unhappy, I think. And, of course, a lot of the women, I think, suffered a good deal because they remembered giving up something better than they were experiencing right now. Mm-hmm. I think once they got where they were going, why, it wasn't too bad. These were mostly farm people. There were a few from the city that were adventurers, but most of them were farm people looking for a better place to have a farm. And they were used to a hard life. So pioneering wasn't quite the absolute shock to them that it would be to us. All of a sudden, you don't have anything that you had before. I have watched these exercises, I guess you'd call them, on TV, PBS, where they had the pioneer family in Montana. But these were, after all, imitation pioneers who were used to something else. They did at least get the flavor of what it was like. Realizing that you had to chop no telling how many cords of wood to get you through a winter, and that they finally had to put in the barbed wire fence to keep from being run over by people moving cattle, and the primitive sanitary conditions and all that. Those were pretty faithfully duplicated, but they did, and they had something to compare what they were doing with, whereas with the pioneers, this is the way they'd always lived anyway. They were just doing it in a different setting.
These were people who had been mostly subsistence farmers, probably, right?
I think so.
They'd worked hard, probably 7 days a week kind of thing for mm-hmm. forever.
Yeah.
And were trying to get to a place where there would be better land and so on.
Yeah, more opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned Absalom Hardin, and he got down into the Willamette Valley country where it's all lush vegetation and pretty damp. And he just rhapsodized over the beauties of nature. He just couldn't get over what a beautiful world it was down there.
Mm-hmm.
He thought he was in paradise, really.
It must have seemed like a garden.
Yeah, it did to a lot of
people. Them. Like a garden. But we could backtrack just a little bit geographically. Coming into the Grand Ronde Valley, we haven't gone in that direction yet today in this conversation. Coming into the Grand Ronde Valley, then they would have come up out of the Baker Valley up over Ladd Hill,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And there are quite a few traces of the trail that are visible up there. None that are all that easy to get to, although, one or two of them are not so hard to. It was a pretty straightforward route and followed the route of the freeway pretty closely. Up on top, there's that nice little high meadow up there that the pioneers called Clover Valley. I don't think it has any clover in it now, but Clover Creek gets its name from that. And it's a little intermittent trickle that dries up in the summer. From there, they went straight on north across the top of the ridge. They couldn't go down the canyon, of course. So they went across the top of the ridge, and when they got to the north side of it, then they went down. And there is... It's an interesting hike. I have hiked over it up near the top, and you can't really see that from down below because it's in a fold in the hill, but there is a big aspen grove up there, and rather a pleasant spot. They didn't stop there because they didn't usually didn't stop until it came evening or time to camp. But I think they probably admired it. From there, it drops down pretty steeply, and then it makes a bend to the north. It has to, because if you go any further, you're too steep, and you'll be right down in the into Lad Creek over rough area. So they had to turn north and go around the side hill a ways. And at that point, the ruts, I think, are about 4 feet deep. It's quite a trench.
Yes, I walked up there a few years ago. That's quite a thing to see. And just to speculate as to how they came down that hill is very interesting, because there's some very steep
There were a lot of timber up there on top, still is, to the south side of it. But they would cut trees and use them to break their descent. Idea was to cut the limbs off on one side of the tree, leaving a stub about a foot long of each limb, and then when you towed the tree down, the branches would keep it from rolling, and the limbs would dig in, and this acted as a brake coming down the mountain. The ordinary wagon brakes probably wouldn't have worked very well, so they had to, they didn't belay with ropes around trees. They did that above Hillgard Park. When they came down that one, it was heavily timbered, and they had plenty of trees to use to let themselves down a little more easily. But on Lad Hill, they were coming down a bare hill, and they had to bring a tree with them. And you hear stories yet about, for years afterwards, there was this great pile of old logs lying there.
At the bottom,
yeah. Mm-hmm. I imagine it's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One way to get down.
Well, when they got into the valley then, they would have then come over, as we were saying earlier, they would have come along over toward what is now B Street, and then they would have camped at the bottom of the hill.
When the first year or two, maybe just the first year, they went out into the middle of the valley. That's what Fremont said anyway, and he followed in their tracks. And then he said they crossed the river, I think. He said they crossed the river, and he said they left the valley by a ways as steep as the one they'd used to come in.
And that would have been basically the Fox Hill route.
That would have been the Fox Hill route, yes.
But after that,
I think it was within maybe 3 years, they started using the route that's now followed by the Foothill Road.
Mm-hmm.
Except that they, and a surprisingly large part of it, they were well above the current Foothill Road, up the slope a ways. They did this partly because there is a level bench that runs along up there, not completely level, but if I've got some pictures of it. In the late afternoon, if the sun is shining at the right angle, then it's kind of highlighted where it rises and falls. And from out in the valley a ways, you can see that. And that's the way they went. They talked about how many springs there were along the west side of the valley, and there are quite a few still. And they stayed up above all of that marshy area, and much of it was marshland at that time. Lad Marsh is a pretty small patch of it compared to what it used to be 150 years ago. But they went that way, and there was a period in the 1870s, 60s and 70s, when they were still going along that same route, and then they went around the southern end of the valley, also in a foothill road, to get to Union, because they couldn't come out across the valley very well at that time. It was all marshy. Later on, they did manage to get a road across that went along the Sand Ridge. And that was another one of the early routes into the valley. It's the one, nobody has identified it as that, but I'm sure it is the one that Shaw's men used when they came over on their expedition, which was the so-called Battle of the Grand Ronde in 1856. And it wasn't really a battle, but they used what Shaw referred to as a secret route known to the Indians that guided them. And what it really was the route up the Umatilla River to a place, well, it's called Ruckel, where the road, or trail then, crossed the ridge, and then it descended down to where Somerville is now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then they came into the valley that way and surprised the Indians down at about where Riverside Park is. But the and the Indians were gathering their winter food supply, and they weren't having a big wartime powwow as the propaganda had it. And it was more a slaughter of 50 or 75 women, children, and old men that were gathering food. And then the Shaw's volunteers took the horses they wanted, killed the rest, and destroyed, I think, 150 pack loads of food that the Indians had gathered for their winter food supply. The general who was in charge of this country at that time, that was 1856, when they were having enough troubles already with the Indian wars that were all over the Northwest, Shaw and his men received strict orders that they were not to engage in any more expeditions. I think the idea was, we'll hang you if you do. And Shaw seems to have been a decent fellow, but the guys that were serving under him were just an undisciplined rabble. They were a problem to everybody, let's put it that way.
Yeah, that's not a very pleasant chapter in the history.
No, it isn't, but we're fortunate that it's the only one of its kind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was usually a pretty peaceful place for everybody. The Indians traded here, and the settlers, when they came through, traded with them. And it didn't have a very dark and bloody history, although until about 1829, I think it was, it had been snake country. And it was kind of off limits to most of the people, the indigenous peoples, as not being a safe place to go.
Then it was, then who was it, Nez Perce or Cayuse?
Cayuse principally.
Yeah.
The Cayuse, Umatilla, and Walla Walla are all pretty closely related, and the Cayuse and Nez Perce are very closely related. And the Nez Perce were over here some of the time. To visit their relatives, probably, and they were up here, but the valley here was largely Cayuse territory in the summer. They pasture their horses here, and usually I think they had a pretty good summer. They liked to do that, and they gathered their winter food supply and took it back home. Yeah. So it was an area that nobody lived here the year round, and for a long time people passing through would remark on what a beautiful place it is. Nearly all of them did, and would love to settle here if only it wasn't quite so remote, and they couldn't be sure that the natives would always be a peaceful people. And of course the time came when they weren't peaceful anymore, because they'd had about all they could stand. It must have been an interesting place to see it as it was before it was modernized, with draining the streams to get farmland and cutting trees to make room for crops and this sort of thing. The original Indian name for it, Kopkapi, means place of cottonwoods, and there were cottonwoods along all the streams. We don't see quite so many cottonwoods now. And of course the river doesn't wander all over the valley like it used to, it having been ditched beginning in 1872, I think. They started the state ditch very early. That was what the Bureau of Reclamation would call an improvement, and for certain purposes it certainly was. It was all swamped with bayous and meanders and oxbows and brush all the way from Island City to Union. Great for duck hunting, but I think about all the people who settled here at that time could think of was getting it drained so I could grow something.
Right, so they could make pasture or farmland.
Sure.
Could we talk for just a few minutes before we stop today about other roads? Because there were stage roads that came in after a while that replaced the trail coming in and out of the valley, right? There was one.
Yes.
Went out through where the present Interstate 84 comes in from the west, right? It did go up the canyon toward Hilgard, right? In later years.
Yes, there's a, I should go back to the route that Shaw followed when he came by his so-called secret route. That later became the Thomas and Ruckel Road. and it was a stage road. The Thomas Miracle Road went across the valley, Sand Ridge, and then across to Union, which meant that La Grande was being largely bypassed by traffic. Jim Pilot put his road at Piles Canyon in, I think, 1864, something like that. And it was a pretty primitive road, but it was more direct, and everything started coming that way. It was a much easier trip than coming over Ladd Hill. There was a little appeal in the 1868 paper, the Grand paper, for volunteers to improve the road. They were going to get together and improve the road over Ladd Hill so that it would be fit for travel, and they did. And that is a road that comes about the same route down Ladd Hill as the old Oregon Trail, that comes down the canyon that's just beyond there. There's a draw with switchbacks in it. And I imagine that road, whether it's still passable or not, I don't know, but that's what it is. And they used that, so that improved Lorraine's situation a little bit.
Right, I think that's the road you can see from the left, on your left as you go up the hill toward Baker City, as you climb out past the rest area.
Yeah, the bottom end of it is still used to service those utility poles that are up on the slope. Mm-hmm. But once you get to the bottom of that draw, then it goes on up the draw, and that is the
stage road.
That's the improved road.
That would be in the late 1860s if that would have been improved.
Yeah, about 1868 or so. Mm-hmm. And who's the famous artist that painted the views of the Oregon Trail? Old age is getting to me. But he painted the wagon trains at the Grand Ronde, that is, coming into the Grand Ronde, but he shows them descending the road that the settlers improved in 1868, not the old Ladd Hill descent. But that was the way he saw it, but he came late, you see.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But name's famous, I'll probably think of it in a little bit.
That's not Bierstadt, no.
No, that he was the landscape artist. This was, I'll think.
We'll put it in later when you think of it.
The other roads, well, the old road west of La Grande that goes up over the top of the hill and across the flat. In 1861, and this is just before settlement here, the government kept about the only promise it ever did keep with the Umatillas, and it did build a road around the southern side of the reservation so that presumably there wouldn't be this constant flow of people across their land. And what they did was to, at the head of B Street, they went on up to where the bench is, and then put in a switchback to go up over the top of the hill instead of that route that went straight up. They fixed that, and then from there they stayed right on the Oregon Trail west until they got to the point where the old trail makes a half bend to the north and descends to Hillgard. The old Reverend Road then turned off to the southwest and went down into a canyon up the other side and on straight to the west toward the Grand Ronde River. And that there are traces of that road that you can still spot up there if you know what it is you're looking for. It wasn't used very long because it was so bad.
Was this the toll road you were talking about?
No, this was the government road.
This was the government road.
Yeah, it was the way people were supposed to go. And the later surveys that show that do not show the Oregon Trail any longer. It was either obliterated at that point or something, no trespassing here or whatever they did, but it was abandoned. Mm-hmm. And they went on to the west. That was a terrible route. I think it came over around Pilot Rock somewhere. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it was said to have crossed the river, forded the river, I think, 19 times. Mm-hmm. And it was awful. take a look at part of it now, you wonder how they got anywhere without wrecking the wagons. E.S. McComas, who came out in 1862 and did some mining over around Auburn with some friends, went down to the Dalles that winter for a load of supplies. The team wagon thought nothing of it. It was just typical travel, you know, in those days. We would think it was pretty rough. But that road was one, and it wasn't used very long. The Meacham Brothers Toll Road, Consolidated Wagon Road Company, was already in existence, and it was a toll road across the mountains beginning 1861 or thereabouts. And so the Indians didn't really have too much of a decrease in travel, at least of the big stuff, the freight wagons and stages. And by 1868, they had gotten their road extended all the way down the Grand Ronde Canyon to the valley, so that you didn't have to go over the hill anymore. And so the old road on top of the hill is just forgotten. And after Harvey Meacham's death in 1872, his widow married a man named Foster, who had worked for them at the Meacham Station, and he did some more improving of roads of his own, and he built the Foster Toll Road, which kind of parallels the Oregon Trail route in a way, and to an extent. Some of the stage route I would like to know more about, and I don't know of a map of it anywhere. It may be that the Forest Service has traced some of it. Bob Reynolds, who worked for the Highway Department, a man who chased Oregon Trail remnants for years and taught me a lot of what I know about it, always thought that probably the stage road, or one of them, might have come down California Gulch. It would be a natural route, certainly, and there is one man writing about a trip to this part of the country named D.H. Stearns, who did a little book called A Tour of Union County, which is interesting. Said that they changed horses at midnight at Meacham's and went along on pretty level country for quite a ways through the open timber. Then it just dropped down, down, down. Well, if they had gone down California Gulch, that's the way it would have been. Mm-hmm. And it's about the only way that it would have been that way. So I think there must have been a road down California Gulch. But Bob said he thought he had found traces of corduroying in the bottom at one time, that he had a bad heart and was heavy and he couldn't walk very far. So he never really did get down in there and hike around. Mm-hmm. So there may have been one down that way. But we got several. The original route, and then the wagon road company, and then the stage route. And just down by Cayuse, there was a place called Cayuse. Well, that was Cayuse Station. That was, they call that Crawford Station. And it was right at the bottom of the hill. And then Crawford Hill was the one that goes up the north side from Cayuse up to Dead Man's Pass. And the freighters that were killed in 1874 were the ones whose names contributed to that. They were among the people who died there.
But the road that came into the valley on the what became Highway 30, mm-hmm. Coming in from, say, Hilgard into the valley down the river, would have been in the late 1860s. They would have extended that in the canyon, the bottom of the canyon.
Yeah, they got it down the bottom of the canyon by 1868. And it came out at Oradell, which of course no longer exists, but that was the little village that William Snodgrass established right at the mouth of the canyon. And he had put in, a flour mill and a planing mill, or a sawmill, and he had a store and a saloon and other buildings, some houses, and it was kind of his town. You know, he owned the whole thing pretty much. And then he had the big store up in Old Town in the 70s and 80s. He moved down to Depot Street, just north of Washington. And that business, that area, survived the fire of 1886. But it didn't survive the fire of 1891. And when he burned out in that, when he lost $30,000, he wasn't insured, and he never rebuilt. But it's a shame that Oradell's completely gone, but it's under Highway 84 if anybody ever wants to dig it up and look at it.
Well, Jack, I want to thank you today, and we'll stop for today and hope to continue this next time. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.